Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. Join us on our journey into the past, the present, and the future as we explore the relationship between technology and humanity. Together, we're going to find out what it means to live in a society where everything is connected and the only constant is change. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impact of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io.
Arco.
Sean.
I feel like the center of the universe is so far away sometimes. Other times I feel like I'm smack dab in the center.
I have a news for you. The center of the universe, it is really, really far away. So it's not that you're feeling weird about that. It's the vision of us, the planet being in the center of the universe, that's way, way far gone. So on the other hand,
there's not flat either. You're probably gonna tell me.
Yeah. On the other hand, we as human should be at the center of our own universe.
Exactly.
And if that's where you're going,
that's exactly I was time traveling to that point. Yeah, exactly.
To that time. Yes. And there was a time when the internet was invented.
That's right.
You remember that time?
I think I do.
You do? You're that old?
I think I'm that old, unfortunately, the gray hair to prove it. I was around and I saw it, and it certainly has changed dramatically. Who's using it, what they're using it for, how it enables us to live our lives, and how we want to live is ultimately shaping its direction as well. And that's exactly what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, I'm actually excited for the guest that we have on and the organization that she represents. It's
yes.
a conversation we wanted to have a while back. We never really had the opportunity, so we need to thank Lan Jensen
yes.
for connecting us. And again, thank God it's not just the two of us chatting
That's
and grabbing.
Right.
So let's introduce our guest, Sean.
Our words would blow
I'll
up
let
the
you
universe.
Do the honor.
Well, it is a true honor to introduce Mei-Lin Feng. Thank you so much for joining us today. And we're going to learn about you and the organization you started with Vint Cerf and where things are headed in that regard. So a little bit about yourself to kick it off, Mei.
Sure. Hi, everyone. I'm speaking here from California, but I've lived on four continents and I was born in Singapore. So that's been a long journey, which has brought me here to this show.
To the center of the universe.
My odyssey. So I am also known as the godmother of CRM, customer relationship management, because in 1989, Tom Siebel hired me from Intel to bring some of what we were doing at Intel over to Oracle. And we did the first system that was the prototype CRM, which is called Oasis. And over the next 20, 30 years, CRM has become the largest software category. And honestly, I watched in horror as the godmother of CRM, feeling that how did my baby become a serial killer? And when I say serial killer, I was really, really conscious of the good ideas behind CRM and how relationships should be supported by technology. So because of that, I joined up forces with Vint Cerf to found the People-Centered Internet in 2015, because I knew that what had happened to CRM was going to happen to the internet. And lo and behold, here we are. And there are things that we can do and we should do, and that's what the People-Centered Internet is about.
Yeah, that's definitely a very dear topic to us. As ITSP Magazine, as we hope by now our audience knows, is at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. So we care about this connection, and we cannot think technology without society at this point, and who serves what. And I think that that's the core exactly of what a people, an internet that works for the people, a center, the people-centered internet.
Well, it's a relationship with technology, right?
Yeah.
It's a bi-directional serving, if you will.
So how this need was felt so early, honestly, in the industry, in the researcher? I mean, how did we start seeing that things were not maybe going the right way?
Well, for me, it was very early because I was in Oracle in the Wild West days. My colleagues were pulled up in front of the SEC to testify. Software revenue recognition was that's when it happened. We were the test case. And I look today at the Wirecard scandal, and I see many things about what happened back then in Oracle, pushing the envelope. Oracle didn't go as far as Wirecard. But we really were at the digital transformation moment of when software was really going through all businesses. And we were just pushing. And the idea that digital transformation changes not just the mechanics, but the values and the culture, I saw that happen inside Oracle. So for me, it was very clear, even in the early 90s, the technology was creating an environment in which people would be faced with very tough choices about the future of society, and that they would be surrounded by others who would be saying, just shut up and get it done. So I met Sandy Parakilas, who was the whistleblower for Facebook. And we were like sharing stories, we were feeling very connected, because he said he wanted to whistleblow in 2011 about what was happening at Facebook. And he quit. But he didn't dare tell anybody for 6 years, 6 years in which we could have stopped a lot of things, including mass killings in Sri Lanka and the Rohingya in Myanmar. And that is my home, Southeast Asia, that I'm talking about. It was very close. It was an appalling example of where employees inside a company can feel that something is not quite right, but where do we go? When I was 35 years old at Oracle, I promised myself that I would be there for the people like me who are caught in the middle of these dilemmas. And so I've really become the person I needed back then. And that's what the people-centered internet is about.
I love it. And you gave a pretty dramatic example there of some of the things you experienced. I'm wondering, are there the other things we should be looking back to identify as, you know, that was a moment in time we recovered from it, but we're about to do it again if we're not careful?
Right now, the UN has said that the highest priority is to get, you know, connectivity to learners into schools, that we face a potential for a lost generation. You know what that means? Lots of RFPs. RFPs out there. And, you know, people who don't have the best interests of society in mind, basically picking them up. And so for me, it's very important to raise the flag that communities and community agendas and community aspirations, communities can own and operate networks. But the policymakers don't even think of that as a potential. The Internet Society and the People-Centered Internet, IFLA, the International Federation of Library Associations, the ITU, many of us realize that people can actually help to shape their future on connectivity. But if the RFPs are issued and they're all taken up by people who are only driven by the profit motive, by ARPU, average revenue per user, then we've left a huge opportunity about how the global brain gets connected. The global brain could get connected for a better life, for a thriving planet, for flourishing people. Or the global brain could get connected to become a mass criminal. And we're really facing that moment right now.
And the first step in that, well, maybe the step zero is we have a problem. Step one is an RFP, right, with some options to solve it. But as we've seen time and time again with technology, we rush to build stuff, and we rush to deploy stuff, we rush to use things. One, they're shiny and new and cool and fun, but they also presumably solve a problem. But we tend to forget that there might be side effects, right? We take this drug, we use this app, and there are side effects with it. How is the work you're doing with people-centered internet perhaps help to elevate and raise awareness for what some of those side effects might be?
I think the best, you know, I think they say, what is it? You can fool some of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all of the people all of the time. And that's what the people-centered internet is all about, participation by all, an internet of the people, by the people, with the people. And that is our best shot at a better future, is having everybody involved. Few people know that that was the spirit at the beginning of the internet. So while people know me for having co-founded the People-Centered Internet with Vint Cerf, one of the fathers of the internet, they often forget the person at the other side of the first node of the internet, which was Douglas Engelbart at SRI. So SRI and UCLA were the first two nodes of the internet. Douglas Engelbart's spirit of networks of communities pervaded the entire spread of the internet. It was not engineering that spread the internet. It was an Engelbart idea about networks of communities sharing and learning together. It was he who first said, well, if our computers are connected, let's take a look at the directories of each other's computers. It was mind-blowing at the time, but that's what he suggested. But he did it in the spirit of sharing and learning and building together. And that spirit was so powerful that the internet spread by people. The World Bank isn't behind the internet. No country is actually behind the internet. It was volunteers who came together to say, you know, this could help my people, my future, my family. And that spirit was really from Engelbart's original vision about how networks can help us flourish, how can we can connect to thrive.
And that was a very thought that was inspired by the core, of course, of the people that invented the internet, which was inside university, academy. And that, as you said, that excitement about sharing knowledge. Knowledge is power if we can put it together and we know boundary. And that's why maybe if you look back, it may sound a little bit naive when we look at cybersecurity and like, why didn't we design it with more security in mind? And I had this conversation with other people that is like, well, because at the time we didn't think we needed it. It was a very exciting moment. And
it was open yet closed still, right?
Yeah, it was open.
A certain number of people could use it.
I beg to differ.
Really?
I know that you guys.
There you go. All right. Because I was wondering when things went wrong, right?
So the very beginning of the internet actually required identity. So backlinks were a requirement. If you look at Ted Nelson and his concept of Xanadu, all of the ideas that would actually have allowed us to be far more secure now were there. Engelbart used to think that the idea of backlinks, going all sources for your backlinks, today the internet's working on forward links. But in fact, the original idea of the internet had backlinks so that every source could be identified. You couldn't hide. You would know where it came from. Engelbart used to think that Tim Berners-Lee thought that the overhead machinery overhead would be too high to do the backlinks. That's why he didn't design it into the World Wide Web. But I actually asked Tim Berners-Lee, and he said he didn't think it was necessary. So in fact, Engelbart thought it was because technically it was too much overhead, but Tim Berners-Lee actually didn't agree. And so there are decisions made along the way which have caused us to be where we are. And I think it's interesting to talk to Tim Berners-Lee about this. That would be a fascinating discussion, whether or not he thought that was a good decision nowadays. But if we had backlinks, we would know who was there. The other Engelbart idea, which was never implemented, partly because of we technically just didn't have enough machinery to do it, was the idea of a linked database. So today we keep talking about data as the new oil, data this, data that. But actually, with networks, the links are some of the most incredible things, because it's how in our brains we think. It's the linkages in our brains, our neurons firing together, that actually allow us to make connections. And I'll just take a male-female perspective. Data is kind of male and links are like female. And by not having enough women at the leading edge of making decisions, we have completely forgotten the immense value of the links.
So what does that mean for us as society then? What are we heading toward, or what do we have that we need to design out of and toward?
Well, Sean, that's such a big question for little old me, really.
You have all the answers. let me give you an example, because we've had a couple conversations where there's this idea of I don't call them micro, but certainly segmented internets. Countries having their own that are separate from other countries, perhaps even societies. We did a podcast this morning where they were talking about a construction internet that really managed only things related to construction and all the devices and data. So now, granted, that's not the World Wide Web, but those types of segmentations could change how we define those internets and how they interact or not, even.
Believe it or not, that was there in Engelbart's vision, and you can look all the way back to 1968 for this. So Engelbart talked about the open hyperdocument system. And why he called it a hyperdocument system is that depending on who you were and what links you'd come to the site on, you would see something different. So I am fully for a transportation construction perspective, because it's appropriate that what we want to look at should be based on our, not just our own history, but our intentions and what we're looking for when we're doing that in service of a particular purpose. On the other hand, if I just go into a party and I want to say hello to people and meet people, I'm not intentionally like, what are they going to do for me tomorrow kind of thing, but just, who are you? Where are you from? Kind of. So we come into these conversations and dialogues with different personas, and being able to reflect those personas is what I'm seeing as a spectrum of offerings that make the internet far more valuable. I think it's really too kind of macho to say, well, okay, it's my territory, my internet, and so on. I'm Chinese. I grew up in Singapore. There's different cultures all over the place. We have to respect each other's cultures and know that, you know, in some cases, in fact, many, you know, pornography is really a difficult question. And especially for children, we don't want our children being able to stumble over it. So I think communities should have the ability to talk about what is good for us and our families, but not do it in a way which is, well, just because you do that, now you've got a big wall and now cut off from everyone. No, it's normally what we do, right? You go into a place, and when in Rome, do as the Romans. It's just a human thing. But I think with technology, we try to make decisions that are way bigger than our capability of managing. And so let's be humble about moving into a huge frontier. That's actually what Engelbart said. We keep trying to apply our ideas that we've developed so far in the last 30 years. We're now masters of the universe, but actually the universe is much, much larger than what we know in the last 30 years. And I've got a great metaphor for that. IPv4. If you put all the addresses in Internet Protocol version 4 into something the size of a beach ball, we're now shifting to IPv6. How big is that if you put the same volume pro rata up? It's the size of the sun. It's the size of the sun. How can we take our intuition developed in a beach ball and apply it to the whole sun? This is ridiculous.
It's definitely a different perspective altogether there. I'm following.
I like that we're back to the universe, though.
I am. But let's trust the universe, and let's talk about trust and ethics, because as you're presenting all your idea, mm-hmm. I would like to know what nowadays the people-centered internet is focusing the most. We've gone a long way. It has become something that maybe we didn't expect that it was going to be. How do we kind of take it back to serve us as humans, and what are the most important, what are you focusing on the most right now? Because I'm sure that you could go left and right and like a ping pong ball, but what are the most important things right now, maybe even connected to the particular situation that we're living right now in the world?
So Vint Cerf was a member of the UN High Level Panel on Digital Cooperation. The reason for this panel is really clear to those of us in technology. It was chaired by Jack Ma and Melinda Gates. It was set up by the UN Secretary General. And for the first time ever, the UN Secretary General is in fact an electrical engineer. He was former Prime Minister of Portugal, but his first job was Associate Professor of Signals Processing and Communications Theory. So suddenly at the top of the UN, we have somebody who really understands digital.
I love that so much. You have no idea.
And he really looked at the UN and he saw different parts of the UN all having their AI for good and blockchain and machine learning. And in fact, there wasn't digital cooperation inside the UN. Everybody would say, I'm working at the UN. Oh, you're working at the UN? We're at cross purposes. Oh, they don't know inside the UN. And so there's this whole thing that is happening because we can communicate with each other. We do communicate, but the reconciliation to cooperate, the protocols for cooperation and collaboration are still to be sorted out. So that's really what we're working on, is digital cooperation. But we've added a new word, digital cooperation and diplomacy, because digital cooperation cannot be invented as a machinery response. It's a diplomatic response. And so Fabrizio Hochschild, who is the UN Undersecretary General in charge of digital cooperation, the ITU Development Director, Doreen Bogdan, and Vint Cerf, I, and the German Digital Envoy met at the Internet Governance Forum in November. And we basically agreed to set up an informal network like the beginning of the internet, volunteers coming together where people are seeing the possibilities in their different organizations, but different organizations may not see the whole picture. You've got organizational agendas. So we've got people from the UN, the World Bank, different countries coming together about once a month, and with the call by the UN Secretary General about the 1.6 billion children whose learning has been disrupted, we have found a call to action, and Vint and I have issued a call to action to the technology community to come together. It's a Dunkirk moment. The big players cannot solve 1.6 billion children. You might think it's just learning, but Kenya has had to eliminate the whole school year. Many people go to private school in Kenya. They've gone bankrupt. And what has happened as the school year has been eliminated? Female genital mutilation has risen. The enlistment of children into dangerous jobs and tasks is happening. This is not just a lost generation. It's a real threat to the children of the world. And I think that the technology community needs to rally around and do something, because we've got the power and somewhat the responsibility.
Yeah, and then, I mean, it seems like an insurmountable problem. And you started off by saying at the UN, nobody knew what the other is doing, and those can't see it on the podcast that they're listening to, but you kind of crossed your fingers of some people maybe crossing and not touching, but maybe even pushing away against other people's objectives and goals. So how clearly the first step is, well, let's just raise awareness and bring visibility to what's going on. Is that enough?
It's not enough. Okay. No, it's not enough. But we do have a model, which is the Internet Engineering Task Force. the Internet Engineering Task Force has been going since 1986. It has put forward the protocols that have allowed the internet to rise to the occasion here at the COVID time. Over, 30 years and plus years, the Internet Engineering Task Force, made up of volunteers in open collective review, parallel iterative improvement, have strengthened the internet. The internet we have was made by the people, for the people, with the people. This challenge, which is insurmountable unless you think differently, the internet was impossible, but it happened.
Everything is impossible until we make it happen, right? how many people have been shut down in the past for ideas that were way ahead of their time, and then sometimes they have become reality, and they would call visionary. But I feel like if we don't have visionary, we don't have an evolution of humanity. It's just a physical evolution, but not a mental evolution. If we have internet, if we're working on artificial intelligence, if we have advanced technology and all the things that we have now that sometimes we criticize and we forget how valuable they actually are for our society. We point the finger in cybersecurity. There is this thing about we're always blaming the user, we're always blaming the clients, we're always blaming, pointing out what doesn't work. But let's point out what does work and how beautiful of an instrument, of an invention, the internet has been for us. So I think that taking it back and opening to collaboration, cooperation, conversation, and I like the idea of, being diplomats, connecting, like not going there to declare war, but going there to say, let's not have a war. Let's talk about this in the interest of everybody. And I love what you guys are doing. And I feel like we're not even scratching the surface or what you're doing. There is an entire iceberg underneath. And unfortunately, the time is what it is. But we would love absolutely to have more conversation with you and the people that you collaborate with, the organization you collaborate with, because it's very in line with what our passion is on ITSP Magazine. Yeah, so it's
visionary,
I'm delighted
for visionary beyond what's possible and more toward what we want, right? What do we want? How do we achieve it?
And I lived it growing up in Singapore. Nobody expected us to become Singapore. We were just like another poor, struggling country. Yeah. And now it's the Wakanda of Asia.
Mm-hmm. What is it, 55 years now or 54? What is it, 55?
1965.
Yeah, okay, so yeah.
5 years, yeah.
And I just can't repeat how much I'd love to go there. I've been lucky to go there a couple of times and I missed to go there this year for RSA conference. So a great country and a great connection and for different culture. That's what I like about it. It's the convergence of so many different cultures. It's kind of like it's like the internet, right?
and of course the food is fantastic.
Don't even go there with Sean, because I couldn't stop him from trying everything.
I was on a mission to test as many things as possible when I was there.
Well, we'll go back there, Sean, I promise.
We will.
More food. And May, an
Perhaps
amazing
we'll
conversation.
Yeah,
maybe we'll meet you there.
Okay.
And before that, we'll like to meet you again on front of the microphone and have more conversations. So may this be the first of many, and we hope that our audience enjoyed it. We certainly did, and we thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impact of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io.
We hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you learned something new and the story made you think, then share ITSP Magazine with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, Sponsor one or more of our columns. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.